resuming in-person religious activities, legal and practical considerations. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is another special free webinar in our series designed to help you navigate the unique challenges and opportunities of this COVID-19 season. You can access more of our past webinars and related resources at ecfa.org/COVID-19. Well, we are so pleased to partner with Christian Legal Society in offering today's webinar on resuming in-person religious activities. What an important topic. I want to give special thanks to David Namo and Kim Colby of CLS for helping facilitate this webinar today and also coordinating our great lineup of expert presenters, which you'll hear from today. Speaking of which, joining me today are attorneys and friends of ECFA, Teresa Sidebotham of Telios Law PLLC, Reed Smith of Christian Legal Society, and Scott Ward of Gammon & Grange PC. Together, they will share about religious liberty, duty of care, practical steps to avoid liability, and other important legal considerations. And an important disclaimer, and that is related to today's webinar, that it is not intended to offer legal advice, and ECFA and our presenters will not be advising your organization on questions like whether or when to resume your in-person ministry activities. But we do trust that the information we will share today will be helpful to your organization as you prayerfully make those determinations. Plus, more exciting news, and that is that CLS is offering an excellent resource library with links to additional resources for more questions that may arise for you and your ministry. That webpage is easy to remember at www.religiouslawguidance.org. And again, we'll refer to that page throughout the webinar. But before we get much further, let's take a moment now to pray and ask God's blessing on this webinar and our time together. Heavenly Father, I do just thank you for each ECFA member and friend who's taken time to join us for today's webinar. We know these are times of great challenge and also questions, but also great opportunities to get to share your love and hope to a hurting world. We just thank you for your continued faithfulness to each of us, and we pray a special blessing on Teresa, Reed, and Scott as they share today, and also for each church and ministry that's represented on this webinar. Please help us model integrity and glorify you in all that we do. In Jesus' name, amen. And without further ado, I'll now turn today's presentation on resuming in-person religious activities over to our first guest presenter, Reed Smith with Christian Legal Society.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. And thank you all for coming in. I'm here to talk about religious liberty in the time of COVID-19. So this has been a hot topic, as a lot of you probably know. There have been over 20 suits regarding church reopening. So one of the things I'd like to talk about are the key religious liberty issues that the courts are examining when they're looking at one of these suits and the judge is saying, well, should I allow this church to reopen or not? So two of the key questions at a 30,000 foot level are how the court should balance the rights of the churches to meet against the stay-at-home orders designed to prevent the spread of disease. And then at what point does an emergency stop being an emergency? And I think that's one of the questions that we're wrestling more with now, because at the beginning, I think everyone agreed that this was something that was limited in time, and it was because we were facing a very real threat. And that's not to say that the real threat doesn't exist anymore, but we're getting to the point where it's a question of how long can the government declare an emergency and what circumstances justify that. So looking at those issues, one of the questions is, what are the specific considerations that a church will make or that a court will make when deciding on a church reopening suit? So one of the key questions is, what are the types of activities allowed under a stay-at-home order? So this is important because it kind of establishes whether religious organizations are being treated the same as secular organizations or whether they're being treated differently. Because there's one key issue is that government can't treat religious organizations differently just because they're religious organizations. It has to have some basis on top of that to say, oh, well, churches present a particular risk of spreading the disease or something along those lines. It can't just say, well, we're including churches in one group and not secular groups in another, in the same group, because that was how we did it. It has to have some justification. The second question is, what are the precautions that the congregation has indicated that it will take? I think that this is an important one, and this is maybe the most important one in the eyes of a judge, because courts want to be assured that when, if they allow a group to meet, that this group isn't going to create a big problem where all, a bunch of people get sick, and then the judge is like, well, my order, you know, possibly killed people. Another important consideration for the court is whether there is a state RFRA, which is a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which that creates a broader and more concrete religious liberty right than in states that don't have a RFRA. And if a state has a RFRA, then the government has to show that the regulation is a it meets a compelling government interest and is narrowly tailored to meet that interest. And then finally, what are the prescribed limits of the government's authority? And we'll get into that towards the end. So one of the key precedents that courts are referring to, and you'll see this referred to in almost every case that's been litigated so far, is Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And this is a very old case. It goes back to 1905. And in that case, it involved someone who objected to getting the smallpox vaccination, and it was compelled smallpox vaccinations. He didn't have a religious reason in that case. His reason was because he had taken vaccinations when he was younger and that they had not sat well with him, as we would say in the South. He had some negative consequences of that, and so he was afraid of getting more vaccinations, and the court acknowledged that vaccinations weren't perfect, but it ultimately said that the government had a real interest in protecting the public health. So in that case, the court said the things that the government must do is the public health order must bear a real and substantial relation to protecting public health. So it's not enough to say, oh, well, we think that this is helpful. You have to be able to show that there's a relationship between the order and the public health interest. The other aspect of that is that the government order cannot constitute a plain and palpable invasion of rights secured by the fundamental law. And so that's to protect rights, even where there's a government interest. It's the regulation can't just say that, well, we're invading your fundamental rights. So in those lines, though, courts are very deferential to declarations of national emergency. And one of the great examples of this is the Korematsu decision from 1944. This is famously the case that involved Japanese internment camps. And the Supreme Court was faced the issue of whether these internment camps, which caused citizens to be able to not live in their homes and basically be detained, were constitutional. And in normal circumstances, there's no court in the country that would find that was constitutional. But because we were facing a war that was an existential threat to the country, the court did find that it was constitutional in that case. And in fact, it was just recently, within the past few years, that the court, in an opinion, said that Korematsu was wrongly decided. But even with that, I think if we were in a situation of another national emergency, that you could very likely see a court be deferential because of the issues that we raised before. In fact, there one example that a number of courts have pointed to already was an article in the New York Times involving a choir that decided to meet. And this was early, back before any state had a regulation requiring people to stay at home. And they took some precautions. Now, you'll see some cases say that they took every precaution, and that's not quite right. They did do some social distancing, but they stood apart, and they used hand sanitizer, although I don't think that there's any indication that they were wearing masks, which is kind of important because my understanding is potentially singing makes the disease a little bit more communicable because it aerosolizes the disease, and so it makes it a little bit more more infectious than it would be in most circumstances. And you'll see a number of opinions have referenced this case because courts are very concerned that they don't want to issue an order and then have that come back where someone's like, oh, well, your order resulted in the death of, you know, three people or five people or one person. So in contrast to the deference that the courts give to declarations of emergency, a number of free exercise precedents have really limited the scope of the free exercise clause. The most important one of these is Employment Division versus Smith. And if you remember when I referenced state RFRAs before, those state RFRAs were basically in basically in response to Smith. So before Smith, the standard for court review was whether a practice that burdened religion, a government law that burdened religion, supported a compelling government interest, and whether it was narrowly tailored to meet that interest, which is sometimes called strict scrutiny. But after Smith, the court said, well, you don't have a free exercise right to an exception to a law that's neutral and generally applicable. And so that means if the law doesn't specifically target religions, then it's not going to, then the court will not say that you have a free exercise right. Now, courts are differing on how generally applicable a law must be, whether any exception makes a law generally applicable, not generally applicable, or whether a law with some exceptions can still be considered generally applicable. And the case that you see cited a lot for this proposition is the Church of Lukumi Babalu I versus City of Hialeah. And in that case, it was the city had passed a number of laws regulating the slaughter of animals. And it was mainly aimed at stopping ritual practices in the religion of Santeria. But they passed a law saying you can't kill animals except if you're a kosher, except if you're a slaughterhouse, except if you're practicing kosher rituals, except if you're a veterinarian that is doing a euthanasia killing. And so the court looked at that and said, well, okay, you've got this worded as generally applicable, but it's not, and we're not going to accept. Except that is generally applicable, and so we think you have to meet strict scrutiny. And in some cases, the court just gets it wrong. So there was a case here in Virginia where Lighthouse Fellowship sued the governor, and part of the court's reasoning in that case, where the order allowed groups providing professional services to meet without limitations, although churches were limited to 10 people, the court said, well, basically this supports the state's interest in employment. And I think if you're getting so far down the road where you're allowing employment to be a compelling government interest, you're really saying that there's nothing that isn't an exception to this, because you could justify opening up almost any business based on the government's employment interest. And so I think that's one where you can really say the court just kind of got it wrong. And speaking of courts kind of getting it wrong, the Supreme Court, as you all may know, weighed in on this issue recently, where a church in California asked the Supreme Court to enjoin the state of California's restrictions. The state of California's restrictions originally, before the lawsuit were filed, were very strict. I think that they were limited to 10 persons. And in response to the lawsuit, the California actually loosened up the restrictions some. So that they said, well, you can meet up to 25% of your building's capacity or up to 100 people, the lesser of the two. In Illinois, there was a similar suit that went to the Supreme Court, and before the Supreme Court decided on that, Illinois actually dropped all restrictions on religious gatherings. So there's no majority opinion from the court, but the Chief Justice, who decided with the majority, did do a concurrence, and he said that there was no injunctive relief available. One of the things that he relied on was that because both the trial court and the intermediate appellate court ruled in favor of the governor, that this was a rare level of injunctive relief that met particularly heightened scrutiny, and said that the churches didn't meet that level of scrutiny. And so he said that the order exempts or treats more leniently only dissimilar activities such as operating grocery stores, banks, or laundromats, in which people neither congregate in large groups nor remain in close proximity for extended periods. I think one of the interesting things is it really calls into the question whether the Chief Justice or any of his clerks are even familiar with laundromats, because you aren't just going to go in, drop your clothes off, and leave. You're going to stay around to make sure that nobody is taking your clothes out the washer and putting their load in, or things like that. So certainly laundromats doesn't even fit the factual scenario that he's discussing. Justice Kavanaugh wrote a dissent on behalf of three of the four justices who would have allowed the injunctive relief. Justice Alito voted to allow the injunctive relief, but did not join the dissent. And his essential argument was, it's fine to say that there are reasons to treat the churches differently than stores, than differently than laundromats. But you have to show not only that there are differences, like the Chief Justice said, that people might stay at a church longer, but you also have to say, well, why is that? Why does that make a difference for the state's goal? And I think that the dissent really got it right on this one, that it's not to say that California could not have made the case to the court as to why the restrictions on religious gatherings were justified, but it didn't. And that's where Justice Kavanaugh and the dissenters came down. So one other issue that we're seeing more and more come up is, at what point does an emergency stop being an emergency? And I think that this is becoming a bigger issue. Certainly we're seeing that a number of cities and states are allowing protesters in large numbers. And in fact, someone asked Mayor de Blasio of New York City about that, and he said, well, I'm not going to treat a protester the same as an aggrieved store owner or a devout religious person who wants to go back to services. Well, generally, an emergency doesn't, your response to an emergency doesn't depend on the message that the person is trying to say. And another example of that is in Contra Costa County, which is in California. They released new guidelines within the past week where you could have up to 12 people for an outdoor gathering or up to 100 people for a protest. Well, you have to justify why a protest is different than just an ordinary outdoor gathering. And so I'd like to, at this time, direct you to our COVID-19 Freedom page, which is where you can kind of keep up with the numerous cases that have been filed, and we talk more about what the Supreme Court decided. And continuing on the themes of lawsuits, Teresa Sidebotham is here, and she's going to discuss the considerations that a court will make when one of your parishioners decides to sue you if you reopen.
Thank you, Reed. This is Teresa. So we're going to talk about COVID-19 and tort liability. So let's start by asking the question, what is a tort? In some context, of course, it's a tasty type of pie, but not in this context. A tort is a wrongful act that results in damage to someone else. There's several types of torts, but the one that we'll be talking about is negligence. So negligent tort involves some kind of negligent or reckless action that results in an injury to someone. Most lawsuits against churches actually are for negligence. So, for example, say that someone slips on an icy sidewalk outside the church and breaks a hip. We may have a tort. Let's talk about the elements of tort liability. You have to have four elements to make up a complete and successful tort. So the first element is the standard of care, which is your duty to take care of people. So in our case of the sidewalk, the duty of the church is to make sure that sidewalks are clear from ice and snow. The second element of the tort is the breach of the standard of care, failing to do that duty. So in this case, it would be forgetting to clear and salt the sidewalk or doing it inadequately. The third element of tort liability is there has to be causation. So your breach of the duty has to cause some kind of problem. In this case, the failure to clear the ice causes a person to fall on the ice. And the last element of tort liability is there has to be some kind of injury or damage to someone. So in this case, the person falls on the ice and she breaks a hip. And you may have all four elements of tort liability. So let's take this from the context of slip and falls on ice to liability for COVID-19. What would happen if someone attended a church service and they contracted COVID-19 and they died? Could their loved ones claim that the church is legally liable? Now, your first question may be, is this kind of far-fetched? Maybe or maybe not. Lawsuits have actually been filed so far against cruise ship operators, nursing homes, and entertainment venues. And we're expecting over the course of time, there could be a lot more lawsuits related to COVID-19. So let's talk a bit about what would the duty of care be for a church or other ministry in the case of COVID-19? Well, the duty of care, first of all, always involves reasonableness. Are you reasonably doing what you should be doing to take care of people? But another piece to COVID-19 is the regulatory orders. There have been a lot of regulatory orders from governors and departments of public health. And probably violating a regulatory order is a breach of the standard of care. Not necessarily for sure, but it's pretty likely. So if there is a regulatory order, that may set your standard of care. If there isn't a regulatory order in place, you should look at what's considered reasonable care at the time. Let's talk a little bit more about ministries and regulatory orders, because your first reaction may be, it's not right that a regulatory order from the state defines my standard of care. And does this really happen in lawsuits against ministries? Well, yes, it does. Here's a couple of examples. In one case, an individual sued a Christian school for asbestos exposure for their children based on violation of a statute. In another case, an individual who fell from a high ropes course sued based on the ministry's supposedly not complying with state safety regulations for entertainment and amusement devices. Now, in that first case, the asbestos case, that got resolved because no one had gotten sick. So in other words, there may not have been causation and there certainly wasn't damages. The high ropes case was resolved because the ministry wasn't in violation of state regulations anyway, and the person had signed a waiver of liability saying, I accept the liability myself. Turning back to the COVID-19 tort claim, the standard or duty of care could be set by the state orders or mandatory guidance, or whether you're acting reasonably. If the church was unreasonable or failed to follow the orders, that could be a breach of the standard of care. Causation could be really hard to establish. Could the person have caught the virus somewhere else, maybe at the grocery store or even out on a walk? Damages would be the illness or death of the person. And another aspect that would have to be considered in the case was what part of that was due to the person's own choices, because after all, they decided to come to church. Perhaps they decided whether to wear a mask or not. Perhaps they decided to come out when they were vulnerable. So there could be other aspects of that as well. You may also ask, will we be protected from liability? Congress is considering liability protections from claims. Several states have already adopted protections for businesses, premises owners, or medical malpractice. But it's important to note that usually these protections require that you comply with safety and health regulations and that you have no willful misconduct or reckless behavior. So you're right back to whether you're acting reasonably and whether you're complying with regulations. Your insurance may usually cover such claims, but you have to be careful that you don't engage in behavior that could void your insurance coverage. So you may say, how should I proceed? What are the recommendations? For liability protection, complying with existing regulations and safety recommendations is a good idea, or at least show a good faith effort that you're trying to. If you think the regulations in your state are untenable or even ridiculous, you may ask for a variance, you could engage in the political process, you could even consider litigation, like Reed talked about. It may help to have a waiver in place, but you usually cannot have liability waived for your intentional misconduct. So if you're going to engage in civil disobedience and that's your calling, you have to think about that pretty carefully. You should also consider checking with your insurance company about what you must do to maintain your coverage in place. I also want to finish this section up by offering a spiritual perspective. It's rather annoying to do things or not do them just because of tort liability or possible liability. But looking at it another way, a duty of care is just how you care for people. So sanitizing, wearing the mask, having these other approaches should be encouraged as a way of protecting the vulnerable and of showing Christian charity to people. So it may be easier for you to handle if you think of it more as a way of showing love to people than as a way of protecting yourself from liability. There are a lot of practical approaches, and for these practical approaches, I'm going to turn it over to Scott Ward, who will take it from here.
Thank you, Teresa, and thank you for that wisdom that I hope to build on now as we talk about some practical considerations. What we hope to do in this next stretch is to talk about what you can do practically and prudently to resume in-person activities in ways that reduce and don't increase risks. I want to first of all provide an overview and a possible structure for how to approach planning and preparing, and then implementing and improving your approaches, and then some specific practical suggestions. So let me begin with a principle that is not legal, but should be foundational, and that's to prepare with prayer. A pastor of mine years ago used to say that all godly action begins with prayer. There's great wisdom in that, and your prayer team should be foundational for your efforts in this area. You should pull together your people and have them praying for your planning, your preparations, your services, the people in your congregation, and the people you hope to reach as you resume in-person gathering. Now, building on that good foundation, after prayer, the best place to begin is by building your team. Who is it who will help you move forward in resuming your activities? Now, here I want to remind us of what Teresa just explained. You're trying to show for legal reasons that you have fulfilled the applicable standard of care. And one of the best ways to do that is to show that you've acted in a reasonable way. You've acted as a reasonable person would act in similar circumstances. Now, one important point that comes within that scope is the fact that to rely upon informed advice, expert advice, is good evidence that you've been reasonable. Different churches will have different resources available, given your size, your location, your congregation. But one way or another, you want to be able to touch on a number of bases. And I like to think of this in two primary ways. There are two components to your team. First of all, the planning portion, and then secondly, the implementing portion. For the planning portion, you want to begin with getting reliable medical advice. At its root, the COVID-19 virus is a medical issue, and you want to make sure that your preparations are medically informed. Now that again will depend on what resources your church has available. I worship at a large church in the DC area. We have a team we call our AAA team. There are three members, their names start with A. One is an infectious disease doctor. One's a doctor who oversees a major emergency room. One's a very experienced nurse practitioner. They're very wise, they're very informed, they're a great source. For a smaller church, just having someone on your team who speaks medical language and can help assign proper weight and credibility to different medical sources would be valuable. But think beyond this group in terms of your implementing team, because these are the people who will carry out your careful planning. This is probably a broader group. It would include your servers. It would include your worship team. It would include your clergy. It would include your cleaning teams, your children's ministry teams, your ushers, and others. And their perspectives are going to need to be reflected in your preparations and then informed as they carry out your plans. So once you've built your team, you want to then think about who is the person in in-person activities that you're resuming. And so I like to think of this as asking the question, who are your communities of care? It may be helpful to begin at the center and then work outward. So start with your staff and volunteers. Their primary role is serving. That exposes them to more potential risks, and therefore you want to make sure that you are not only putting them into use, but you're considering how do you protect them against increased exposure. Beyond that, your next circle is your members, your attendees. And there you're thinking, these are the first round of people we're trying to serve. How do we serve them better? What did we do to protect them? Some churches have undertaken surveys to get a sense of comfort levels, preparedness, needs, and then to take that into account in their resumption of activities. Beyond that, though, keep thinking of your broader community. Who are the people that you're hoping to reach with the love and gospel of Jesus Christ? And how is it that you can invite them in a way that will build trust and confidence and make them feel safe? Now, in thinking about all these things, give special attention to those who may be more vulnerable. There's enormous evidence that COVID-19 has had a grossly disproportionate impact on the elderly, and particularly those in nursing homes. As Teresa mentioned, nursing homes have even been sued for not providing sufficient care. And then in different areas, different communities may be affected in different ways. For example, in my local area, the impact of COVID-19 on the Latinx and Latin American related community has been substantially greater than just about any other community. So think about, is there something you can be doing to serve that community better as you resume your services? And are there special features you should include? Also think of other communities that may be vulnerable, but not in a COVID-19 way. Let me just flag one important one here. Sometimes your changes may relax your child protection precautions. Make sure you've thought about, are we still protecting children even in our new setup for worship and gathering? Well, after you've built your team and recognized your community, it's time to do your homework. And I want to talk about several different ways you do your homework. The first thing you need to do is identify your authorities. What are the authorities that you have to be aware of and address? Now, often we lawyers think in terms of sources of authority, federal government, state government, local government. It's also important to think in terms of what form does the authority take. So, for example, there are laws or regulations. These are the most binding form of authority. They're also the slowest to develop. As Teresa mentioned, much of the action in this area of concern has come in the form of regulatory orders, usually issued by a governor or another executive agency. These generally are providing the controlling legal standards, and therefore they may provide the main standard of care. Now, there's another category that comes under the broad name of guidance. This is by far the most extensive. And this is where an awful lot of the practical information comes out. This may be material posted on websites of government agencies. It may be FAQs or questions and answers. It may be publications. What we're finding is that it is extensive, probably as extensive as we've ever seen, and it takes a lot of wading through. So then you have to say, well, how do I interpret these authorities in an intelligent way? And here I want to suggest several things. You know, lawyers, we tend to think in a default order of a descending hierarchy of authority, federal, state, and local. But when dealing with a medical emergency or a public health emergency, the legal authority is probably a little more state first, then federal, then local, for reasons having to do with the way our federal constitutional system of government structure. And then in practical terms, often what's most useful for you or your church is your local guidance, then state, and then federal. And I'm going to give an example of that in a minute, but let me just leave you with a couple of principles for how to interpret all of these different forms of guidance, because there'll be a lot to deal with. First of all, you should expect that there will be some inconsistencies in the guidance that you see. And so you want to try and reconcile those inconsistencies in ways that show you are reasonable. Be principled, be consistent. Secondly, from liability perspective, it's safest if you prioritize the most stringent, the strictest standards, and then work outwards to relax them. If you decide not to follow the most stringent standard, you want to be able to articulate why it was reasonable for you to do that. What was the reason? Now, when you look for these materials, we wanted to provide a few ways to track this down. Simplest way is just Googling the name of your state, along with words like executive order, COVID-19, et cetera. But we've given you here, and we have on the resource page that Michael referred to, some catch-all sites that will put you in touch with the governor's offices and health departments around the country. So once you've identified your authority and gathered your authority, you then want to ask, well, what questions do these different standards address? And there are several things that seem to be somewhat top of this list. First of all, the orders may address your timetables to resume. When can you start? What are the phases? They will often address your maximum capacity. What percentage of your occupancy limits or how many people? Most of them are addressing social distancing requirements and minimums, and a number of them address cleaning requirements. Now, for all of these, you want to think in terms of what standard does this establish? So if these elements are required, that's very likely going to provide a standard of care. If they're recommended, that's still probably a standard of care, but you've got a little more wiggle room. And if they're just suggested, then that's possibly a standard of care in a lawsuit, but there's more capacity to debate that. Now, you also want to gather information from other reliable resources that you can refer to. So think in terms of medical and health information. There are a lot of resources available that are church-focused or specific. There's a lot of general information. I try to look for things that are objective, that have depth underneath them. I try to sample a broad range of perspectives on the spectrum and then identify the most reliable sources, using them as a starting point, but not necessarily as the ending point. Now, there's so much out there now in our information-saturated world that it can be hard to separate the signal from the noise. That's part of what the members of your team should help you do. And if you're having difficulty understanding regulatory guidance or other information, this is an area where consulting with related organizations, with other churches, sometimes involving legal counsel can be important. Now, a critical principle for doing your homework is that you must update this information often. Assume that the information is going to change, and it's going to change sometimes with very little notice. I have to say, in more than 25 years of legal practice, I have never seen the speed with which laws and regulations and orders and particularly guidance have issued and even been changed. And so you need to be checking that on an ongoing basis. You want to assign an individual to keep an eye on this, just so you know who's on point. Well, once you've gathered all this information, you then want to go through a process of recognizing your risks. Your primary risk, of course, is of spreading a COVID-19 infection, transmission. But there are secondary risks. And in particular, you want to keep asking the question, are there unintended consequences of the good things we're doing that could cause their own harms? When you think about the primary risk, I want to suggest that there's a simple COVID-19 calculus you can do. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control has said the more an individual interacts with others and the longer the interaction, the higher the risk of COVID-19 spreading. You can think of that as creating several different components of a calculus. And those components are some controllable, some not controllable. The controllable ones have to do with the character of your interactions with people when you resume in-purpose gathering. That's space, how close are you, and where are you? That's time, how long are you together? And that's intensity. What are the types of exposure that can be involved? Have you mitigated or reduced that? There are also a lot of factors that you can't control. I call them X factors. And I won't bog us down there, but there are a lot of them. They turn on the fact that we're still early in the learning curve about this entire situation and about this virus in particular. So that gives us a little math equation. It's always dangerous when lawyers do math, but let me take a shot at it here. Your simple equation is that space times time times intensity times the X factors gives you a rough approximation of your primary risks, and particularly those that are controllable. And I think you can use that simple equation to control the variables that are within your control. So first, time. Manage your time. Think about duration of your services. How long? Can you reduce them? Think about number of services. How many are you going to have? How many people can be at each service? Are you better with several shorter services rather than one longer service with more people? Think about structure. What happens during the service? Think about what happens before and after the service. How do you manage for those risks? And then as a general principle,